This is Westfield John, continuing the interview with the author Norman Samuda Smith, part two.
Sounds Beautiful Radio Podcast. We like to get in deep.
There was a period following Bad Friday when it inspired the local community and then also nationally, and you were heavily involved. For example, you were a founder member of Ebony Arts Theatre Group.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that time and the play Ram Jam, which you toured with successfully?
Yeah. Well, it was kind of surprising, really, because you know when you write something, it's like a dream I had when I was 14 that I was going to write a novel, draw the illustrations, do the cover design, and get it out there. So I fulfilled that dream by producing Bad Friday and getting it published. But I had no idea that it was going to take off so big like it did. Because you just throw it out there and you just think, oh, whatever happens, happens. But it so happened that because it was written and based in Small Heath where I grew up, and a lot of people, oh, Norman's written a book, and I mentioned all the street names and everything they related to it, and they just got excited and they said, oh, we want to do a play, we need to do a play. So they came to me and asked me if I would write a play for them and let's set up a drama group. At first I wasn't too interested, but then I thought, you know something, it was like an avenue for me to do some writing. It would help improve me and move into different kind of genre.
Okay. Right, so from a little acorn, a big tree started to grow.
That's right, yeah.
Now on that basis, you've been a busy man, involved in writing and publishing, recitals, play groups, theatre, and some mentoring over the years. Are you still as active? Is there any more plays or novels on the horizon?
Well, in active as in groups kind of a sense, no. But in writing, yes, because writing has always been a passion of mine ever since, as we said earlier, I was 10. Things that are in my head, when you're a creative person, you need to get stuff out there. You know, you need to get it off your mind, because otherwise you're going to sit back in your later years and says, why didn't I do that? And so that,
exactly.
So, there's after publishing three books in 2013, and getting it onto Amazon and promoting it into eBooks and so forth, which I'm working on right now. Next year, I want to clear the decks so that I can write more novels.
Right, so that's your main objective now.
My main objective,
your main
now
goal.
is to write more. There's quite a lot more to come.
Is it better in the publishing world as well today, or is it harder?
It's easier.
Good.
Back in the day, it was a case of sending your whole manuscript, posting your manuscript to the publishers and sitting down and waiting to see if they're going to get back to you. Later on, in the 90s, it was like three chapters you send, and you probably don't even see your chapters again. They're just, if they don't like the first page, that, you know, they just toss it aside. So with the advent of the internet, it's easier now to self-publish your own stuff and be in control of your own stuff.
Yes.
And get yourself out there and, you know, create a website and things like that to draw people's interest to you and to get a kind of fan base going on so that you can
just... Yes, so it heightens your profile, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Very much that kind of technology now.
That's it. And that was my kind of ambition, to be in control of my own writing and publishing. So the internet has helped me in that regard.
So that's always looking good.
Mm.
Now, before we come on to your next little piece of talking to us about the verse or part of a chapter from the book. I mentioned in the opening introduction that you'd written three books, and the other one was Britannia's Children.
Correct, yeah.
Which was written over a 30-year period. All these short stories. Again, when you go on the website and read reviews about it, it is like a seesaw or a roller coaster, the emotions that people go through those short stories, how they relate to them. And there are certain parallels as well, not only to you know, your Jamaican or any sort of immigration, but the population that was here, my own generation. You know, your father's telling you to do right and your mother's doing the same. They want you to be educated.
That's right.
And, you know, we're making mistakes just the same. Yeah. There's a lot of parallels, actually. So, did that, over a 30-year period, were you introducing different stories or were they always there and you brought them out?
No, well, the thing is, most of the stories I came across, again, was by mistake because I was doing a bit of a clean out. And these stories that I'd written them at the time, because you've read Britannia's Children, and you've seen the actual year and dates that the stories were written, and some of them were published in local magazines, not national, but you know, just local magazines here and there and everywhere. And so when I had a folder of all the short stories that I wrote, and funny enough, I had put them in chronological order. So I came across this folder which had written on it short stories. And I was, at this point in my life, I was saying, I need to write another book, because at that time I only written Bad Friday. And people knew about me anyway, that I was a writer and written plays and all that kind of stuff. But the only thing I had behind my name was just Bad Friday. So I said, I need to write another story. But and I came across these short stories and I started reading them and I was like, okay, this is telling a story here. So there was about 20 of them and I whittled it down to 11. And so I reworked some of them, you know, so like improved them from the time when I'd written them, and just threw them all together. And that's why when I say it's written over a period of 30 years, it's not that I was 30 years working on Britannia's Children. It was just stories that I'd written from the 70s right the way through.
Yes, well, that explains it nicely. Because I did read the book, and the opening chapter is very interesting because it kind of shows the innocence there of the dream of England.
Yes.
I love that chapter, actually, the little lad and the streets of gold.
Yeah.
You know, you can just picture that, and of course the ending of the chapter as well. And then woman, the strong characters that the females are.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very good book with all these short stories, and they are short. You can read one straight after another, or leave it for a while and then just go back to a completely new one. So I recommend that anybody listening would certainly read that book to get into the flavour of
great stuff.
And then Bad Friday, which should be easier to read and get the flow of that.
Sounds Beautiful Radio on podcast.
You're going to read part of a chapter from Britannia's Children.
I am, yes.
So if you tell us about that.
Well, the story that I'm writing, that I'm going to read, is from Rasta Love. And basically it's a love story, a teenage love story, of two young black teenagers, around about 16, 17. Errol and Lorraine. And Errol is a young Rasta.
yeah.
And Lorraine is from a family that goes to church every week religiously. And she's going through this transition of wanting to go to dances and learning about the roots and the culture of our African heritage and things like that. And she's kind of attracted to Errol, but her parents don't like the fact that Errol is a dread or a Rasta, and they kind of get in the way of their relationship.
Very wary of him.
Yeah, which incidentally, everybody loves Rasta love, and I'm going to be working on a novel to expand their relationship and see what happens.
Well, that'd be interesting to follow up to that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So the excerpt that I'm going to read from Rasta Love is a dance hall scene, like I was explaining to you before about the sound systems and everything like that. So I'm going to read an excerpt from the dance hall scene because Errol is a sound system member, and he is a rapper or a reggae toaster. He toasts over the instrumental parts of the lyrics and everything, like the reggae tunes and everything. So that's what I'm going to read. So I have to get into character
right
with this thing.
That sounds very good.
Rasta Love. This is just an excerpt from Rasta Love, the dancehall scene. It was winter 1974, -6 degrees and still dropping rapid, while the frost that settled upon the pavement was glistening. The dustman them said they want to go upon strike for well over a week now. Nobody believe how much rubbish can accumulate in 9 days. Every street you walk down, all you see is pure pile of rubbish everywhere. The miner them said they want to go upon strike too. That going to lead to more power cuts again, and we all know what that mean, no dance. Enough brethren and sisters file out the dance on St. Oswald's Road. The brethren them sporting them ice gold green crowns, scarves and belts as them bop with pride along the icy pavement, in of them clerks boots and ting. The sister them majestically wearing them head wraps in various shape, size and colour, with them long skirt, full length sheepskin coat, and for them clerks boots glide alongside the brethren them. Every Friday night, enough of them would get off the No. 8 bus at the Golden Hillock Road, Coventry Road Junction in a small heat around 8. Them destination, St. Oswald's Road Dancehall, to hear the musical Bible of Rastafari featuring Small Heat's baddest youth sound, Aita Naya. There was pure vibes every week. St. Oswald's was Ram. Members of other youth sounds gathered to learn how to entertain the people with pure dubwise and pre-release roots music. And while them listen and learn, the treble section ring in them ears, the bass shake them trousers and rattle them chests, the lyrics educate and make them meditate, pure peace and love in the dance, as the congregation rock cool and easy to every rhythm that touch down. The Aita Naya followers stand up surrounding them amp case as Pedro, the operator at the control tower, mix and blend the music, teasing the crowd with pure treble. Then halfway through a tune, he give them a full dose of bass and it shake everything in its path. The selected them, Berris and Robbo, dig deep in the record box to try and find a next hypnotizing tune. And Errol, cool and easy, chat him own the lyrics in a style and fashion that tastes like milk and honey to the dancehall crowd. Yes, crowd of people, you're in tune to the baddest youth sound, Aita Naya sound, and we know we're no frown. Now don't forget, tomorrow night, all roads lead to St. Agatha's Church Hall, right down there in a Sparkbrook way. You're in tune to the mighty Jashaka from London Town versus Mafia Tone Hi-Fi from the Zells. It's £1.50 upon the door, security tight. So make it a date and don't be late, cause Shaka go and throw down dub plate that no other sound can imitate, seen? So don't worry about the energy crisis, don't worry about the unemployment and redundancy. Don't you know, Ja will work it out, seen? Ja, Rastafari, the crowd replied. Selassie, ever pure, ever sure. Right about now, hold on to the one you love the best without any contest. This your tune, yeah, is One Cut Pan 45. Strictly Dubwise, Gregory Isaacs, your smiling face. Throw it down, rubble. The intensity calmed down for a little while as the brethren them searched for a sistering to hold a dance with in the dim light. Oops! Excuse me, select a rubble. Take it slow as the love grow in the dance hall, you know. As we stop to start again, you got to grab a skirt and see what it's worth. Got to get into the mood, but don't be rude. Just get down and scrub. Rubado.
Well, that was terrific. I mean, that does create an atmosphere, doesn't it?
It does, it does.
And as all youths do, they can drown their sorrows and their worries and just get on that dance floor and let the music take hold.
That's it. That's what Bob Marley always said. Forget your troubles and dance. Forget your sorrows and dance. That's the
motto, isn't it?
Dance Beats on Radio. On podcast.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is on the earth.
You understand?
Bob Marley there. Heroes and role models. Do you think enough is done to promote this aspect of black people's successes?
Difficult. Well, I wouldn't say that's difficult. No, not really. I think in regards to not to get too political or anything like that, but in regards to black history, I think it needs to be thrown into, you know, put into schools.
Yeah.
Because my theory on that is that, for instance, I didn't know up until about probably around about 20 years old, that the guy who invented the traffic light was a black man.
That's right.
You know? And my theory on the whole aspect of promoting black history is not to sort of like throw it in everybody's face, but why not have an image of the guy on their whiteboard or whatever, and says, here's a guy that invented the traffic light, the vacuum cleaner, the refrigerator, the elevator, all those things created
yes.
by black people, and you have the images of these people so that the children can see who they are, rather than have to say, and incidentally, he was a black man. You know what I mean? It's like drip kind of a thing. So
it's like recognition of your own successes through your own people.
Well, yeah, you know, it's
you're part of the world.
Funny enough, it's like you got history and then you got black history, and history is history because we're all intertwined, you know. And I think more should be made of our contributions to the world.
Yes, I agree with that, because it's only when you get into, as I did, following up on your books
mm-hmm.
and your web pages, that I saw that for the first time.
Mm.
Those things you've just mentioned.
Yeah.
And the first black footballer was captain of Scotland.
Absolutely. Yeah.
to play England.
Never known.
No.
Yeah.
So it's something then that needs to be done for mm-hmm. you in that respect. I thought about asking this one, but I will, because we're just sort of following on from that. Can knowledge of your history and roots actually hold your cultural development back if the focus breeds sort of resentment of things that happened, say, hundreds of years ago? It's how do you move on to the present and future and express yourselves today?
Well, I think you're talking about the slavery aspect of things, which is sort of like highly promoted to say, you know, within schools to say that black people were slaves. But the thing is that slavery happened. Okay, we know that happened. But the whole idea of promoting our culture, our history and everything is to say before that, we were a great nation, Egypt and various empires within Africa. So it's a case of saying it was not, or that was just a blip in history where blood vessels burst in men's brains and they thought, well, you know, it's all right to put somebody else in slavery, although it was there all the time.
Yeah.
In various nations and various guises and various cultures. But it's a case of getting over that and just saying, yeah, we are a great people. We had a little blip there, but.
Yeah, we move on.
We move on.
We'll be right back. people can't even find their feet.
Struggle from Basil Gabaldon's brilliant album called Breathe Again. Norman. So, taking it a little further from that then, I mean, do you feel you have strong leaders from this sort of hybrid generation with specific goals? I mean, you just mentioned there about promoting all these people that have done so much and yet they're in the shadows. So, have you got local heroes coming through, or nationally, people that are pushing for the things that you've mentioned?
Not that I can think of right now, but I guess you could look at role models such as your Kobe Bryant's nowadays, who play basketball. You know, in the past, like Magic Johnson, Pele. People like that, and your Martin Luther Kings, and so forth. I can't see anybody that's really that prominent right now, because there's a lot of craziness going on in the world. You know what I mean?
It is at the minute. Yeah, certainly. Okay. The Windrush generation, 1950 and the early 60s then, coming to the mother country, Streets of Gold, was a period of disappointment. Do you think the current generation see Britain still as a land of opportunity, and are they grasping it, or is there something still inherently wrong?
I think at the moment we're just here, and everybody wants to, I would say, depending on what kind of ambitions they've got, is to, you know, have a job and just to get by and look after their families. I think with my parents and my parents' generation, when they came over, the main goal for them was to come over for about 5 years, make a bit of money and go back home, build a house
and be comfortable
with the English pounds that they earned, and then whatever happens after that when they get back home, they deal with that. But it so happened that they got over here and they got trapped, you know, and you know, they had to go through finding accommodation and just generally getting through it, surviving to the next day. And then all of a sudden they've met their partners. Some of them were already married when they came over, and they sent for their family later. Some met their spouses here, and they just in the end ended up laying down roots, and here comes me and
yes
and the rest is history. And we were talking like three generations on now, because I'm talking like grandchildren now.
Yeah. That's right, yes. But do you still think there's opportunity? It's a better world to try and achieve something with all the, particularly educational, technical education.
Yeah.
Electronics and the internet.
I'd have to say the last 30, 40 years, Britain has come a long way in respect of tolerance, yeah. Even though it's being tested right now, at the minute. But tolerance wise, I mean, it's much better than what it was when my parents was here, but there's still underlying stuff that's going on, you know, and stereotypes and whatever, because you get good and bad in everybody. But you know, so it's slightly better, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
Where can our audience obtain your books, or find a site that you would recommend so they can follow up on?
Well, if they want to find my books, they could just go onto Amazon and type in Britannia's Children, Norman Samuda Smith. The book will come up. Bad Friday, Norman Samuda Smith. Freedom Street is not on Amazon at the moment. If they can go to my website, Panther Newsletter, which is, I'll spell it out, is http://panthernewsletter1.wordpress.com. And my other site, which is Samuda Smith Publications, all together, .wordpress.com. And you find all the information about my books and everything on there.
Thank you, Norman.
You're welcome.
And I hope people log into that, because there's certainly interesting books.
Oh, it's
not only
logging onto my site Panther Newsletter, but they'll get a very good education of history and interviews of other artists that I've interviewed. And in fact, our producer today, LA, I might be interviewing him at some point in time next year for my newsletter.
There you are. Reversal.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that concludes this interview with the author Norman Samuda Smith. Until next time, this is Westfield John on Sounds Beautiful Radio, broadcasting on podcast. Looking forward to the next time. Bye-bye.
Sounds Beautiful Radio. We like to get in deep.
This is Sounds Beautiful Radio.